You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 514. Being an artist means not having to avert one's eyes. Akira Kurosawa.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Vidafair. In a world where filmmakers are trying to find new ways to generate revenue with their films, Vidafair lets filmmakers set their own price for a 24-hour rental of their work, which includes features, docs, and perfect for short films. This is truly a revolutionary way for filmmakers to generate revenue with their content. For more information, head over to vidafair.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have television director Dan Arias. Now, Dan is not just a television director. He is a legendary television director. He has worked on pretty much every one of my favorite shows in the last 2 to 3 decades. I mean, he even got to be a DGA, a second assistant director on E.T., Airplane, worked with Francis Ford Coppola, George Miller, when he was just coming up. And the shows that he's worked on is basically a top 50 list of the greatest shows ever made. And I'm just going to list off a handful of them right now. Miami Vice, Northern Exposure, Party of Five, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Sopranos, CSI Miami, Alias, 6 Feet Under, Deadwood, Entourage, Friday Night Lights, The Wire, Heroes, Big Love, House MD, Hung, The Walking Dead, True Blood, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Billions, Bloodline, True Detective, Ray Donovan. I just can't anymore. So many amazing shows that Dan has worked on. And he decided to put all of his wealth of knowledge in his new book, Directing Great Television Inside TV's New Golden Age. And if you want to get into not only how to direct television, but how to tell great stories, how to work with actors, how to run a set, how to prep, how to have a mindset to walk onto set, how to overcome those days that are going to be insane on set, and so, so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Dan Arias. I'd like to welcome to the show Dan Arias. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing great. Nice to be here, Alex.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, my friend. I truly appreciate it. You have a new book out, which is about directing great television. And my friend, after doing research, you've shot a couple of TV shows.
Yeah, just a few.
Just a few. I mean, the list, and I'll put this in the show notes for everybody to go to your IMDb page. I just kept going. I went all the way to the bottom. So I see where you start as far as television is concerned. And then I just started going up. I'm like, Jesus, you worked on that? you did 10 episodes of this? You did four? What? And it just kept going and going. So it was pretty remarkable. I mean, as a television director, I don't often see you working on, you know, the same guy who worked on Buffy generally doesn't work on The Wire and The Sopranos and House and all these other. It's just like it was pretty remarkable. It's still a pretty remarkable resume you have. So if there's anyone to write a book about this, you're not a bad candidate.
Well, thank you. I hope I learned a few things along the way and was excited to share them with people.
So how did you get started in the business?
Let's see. Well, when I got out of college, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I had been an English major, got accepted to law school. My heart wasn't in that, so I didn't start. And I gravitated towards acting just as a kind of way to kind of get better acquainted with myself, play a little bit more with, you know, letting go of personality and kind of putting myself into other imaginary circumstances. And I really became enamored of that. And for about 3 years, I studied to be an actor. I got into some stage plays. But I found that my real strength was not so much in acting, because I found I got in my own way. I understood scenes well. I understood what scenes were about. But I found it challenging to kind of reconfigure my internal life to be able fully to embody what the character might require. And I'd understood what was necessary, but I had trouble getting there when I was the one who was going to have to be seen and judged and evaluated. When I happened to wind up in film school as a way to continue to study acting. But in the film school program I was in, I had to make a film, because the idea was, well, if you're going to write about film, or it's a good thing to know just what's involved. And I made a short film, and it was an epiphany. It was I learned that when I was behind the camera, when I could ask actors to kind of inform a character, I found myself very articulate, very empathetic. I was a better actor directing an actor how to get there. I loved giving them the ideas how to get to a performance. And the real epiphany came when I started assembling it. And I saw that by putting two pieces of film together, an emotion, a reaction was sparked in the viewer, in me, when I rewatched it. And I found that if I could monitor how an image affected me, and then an edited image with another one together, how it affected me, I could pretty much reliably count on the fact that someone else would have that same internal experience. And so it became very exciting to me to realize I could communicate my own deepest subjective experience by the way I put together a film. And that was just electrifying, frankly. It was a way I realized I could communicate, I could express, I could share my internal experience with others in a way I never before had been able to. So that was when my career got defined for me, what I wanted to do. And how I actually got work was a little longer of a journey. I wound up getting into a master's MFA program in film school, and didn't have a film I wanted to make to get for my thesis. And I didn't want to be a career film student. I'd seen a lot of the big fish in the small ponds. And I decided, well, until I have a film I want to make, maybe I could apprentice myself to good directors by becoming an assistant director. And I didn't really understand the job of the director. I thought maybe you really do assist the director in directing.
Isn't it the assistant director who storyboards and sets up shots for them?
No, I'm joking.
Okay. I'm absolutely joking.
Thank you, Alex. I can breathe a sigh of relief about who's up here. There is some creativity in it. You get to stage the background. I wound up being a second assistant director on E.T., and I got to stage the background, for example, when E.T. went out trick-or-treating and all the kids are there. And, you know, that was some of my handiwork. But I wound up getting accepted into the Directors Guild Assistant Directors Training Program. I went through that. I was a trainee assistant director on Airplane, the movie. And then I became a second assistant director, and as I mentioned, was fortunate to work with Spielberg on E.T. I got to work with Francis Coppola as a second assistant director on One from the Heart. I worked with George Miller on the episode he directed of The Twilight Zone. I worked with Wim Wenders on a movie called Hammett, which Coppola produced. So I had a great experience, got to work with many, many brilliant filmmakers. And after a short time, I went back to film school, made a short, which fortunately won some film festivals and got me an agent. And from there, I got my first job, which happened to be a feature film. It was Dino De Laurentiis's, he produced it. It was Stephen King's Silver Bullet was my first job, 1985. And, you know, my television career, which I appreciate you kind of enumerating some of my credits, I didn't really start out thinking that would be where I'd land. I wanted to, you know, continue my work as a feature director, but I didn't want to do another horror film. Those were the things that were offered to me after Silver Bullet. And I became very particular and thought I would develop my own material, which I didn't connect to material that I got impassioned about. And so kind of as a placeholder, the TV work came available to me, and I thought it would be, well, something to do until the next feature came along. But the surprise for me has been that it's been in directing series television that I really came of age, I think, as a director. It was fascinating and continues to be fascinating to me to get to confront so many different dramatic or comedic situations, so many different stories and sensibilities to inhabit, stories to tell. And I've grown to just so love immersing myself in so many different worlds that it's become a passion.
Well, let's go back for a second, because I have to ask. I mean, what was it like being on the set of Airplane with Jerry and that insane crew? And
well, Airplane was insane and a great deal of fun. It remains to this day. I'd say between that and I was a producer-director in the early seasons of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I'd say those two experiences stand out to me as kind of the most fun I've ever had on a set. And on Airplane, you know, you mentioned Jerry and the Zuckers and Jim Abrams. You know, there are three directors, and none of them had directed before. They came out of something called the Kentucky Fried Theater, which they had developed in Madison, Wisconsin. And what was so incredible was the freshness of their humor, because now it's become, you know, it's become so much a part of the culture that we all, you know, laugh. You know, don't call me Shirley or those things. But those none of that had penetrated the culture, and it was known to anyone. And so, you know, in those days at lunch, they would screen dailies. Everything, of course, was shot on film.
Right.
We'd go to the lab and get developed, and the editors would sync it up. And the next day at lunchtime, they would show them. The director and others could maybe come and watch. Well, they opened it up to everybody, and it was the hottest ticket in town. We'd all be working all day, but we'd want to spend our lunch hour going to the screening room and just howling with laughter at this incredibly original, fantastic humor. So it was a blast.
I mean, have you ever seen a grown man naked? Have you ever spent time in a Turkish prison?
I mean, funny too. It's like, you know, nowadays I wonder if it could even get naked.
No.
It touches on so many things that have become.
I mean, Blazing Saddles, Airplane, those kind of movies don't. Yeah. I mean, how Borat even was allowed to be made in today's cultures is remarkable. But no, I remember watching Airplane, and I still know that I remember seeing the story that it was one of the worst test screened films of all time for Paramount, because at the time, everyone who watched it loved it, but no one admitted it. They didn't want to admit that they actually were laughing at something so silly, because it was kind of the first time. I mean, it was slapstick, and we hadn't seen slapstick in such a long time. It was just fascinating. But then, of course, it blew up, and everyone lost their mind for it. But it's just one of the funny. And then you mentioned a couple of people: Spielberg, Coppola. What is the biggest lesson you learned from watching like Spielberg work on set like that? I mean, he was Spielberg already at E.T., but like E.T. just took him to a completely other level.
Well, I think what I learned from Spielberg and other great directors I've been fortunate to watch is the importance of trusting your instincts, the importance of having a deep connection to the material, the importance of taking responsibility as the storyteller, the importance of honoring your own vision for it. These are all things which will be interesting. I hope we can get into to discuss how it applies to serious television directing, because that's an area people often don't ascribe those qualities to. They think of it as primarily the writer's medium, the showrunner's medium, and the director, the guest director coming in just for a quick hitter and probably not, you know, having much even responsibility for the storytelling. When the truth is, in my view, I approach every show I direct as my show, even though I have to, qualify that. I have to serve the vision of the showrunner, because a show really needs one vision. And it's my job to understand fully what those intentions are of the showrunners, what the vision is, what their ideas are for the story. But I cannot tell it well unless I make it mine. I cannot, unless I connect to the material in a way I can personally care deeply about, I cannot make anybody else care about it. So I have to, when I'm in the director's chair, have to absorb all of those givens, and then I have to find my particular take on it that cannot be in contradiction to the vision of the showrunner, but it can further it. I can give it my particular take, and I hopefully can add something to it that can only come through me, just as any director has only themselves to offer.
So, and that's so interesting, because, you know, as a film director, as a feature film director, you can create whatever style you want. You can use the camera however you want to tell the story. You can move things around. You can create a visual language that is all on, it's all yours. I mean, you watch Goodfellas and it's a Scorsese film, because Marty gets to do whatever the heck Marty wants to do, and he moves that camera in a different way. But when you walk on the set of The Sopranos, it's David Chase's world, and this world has been set up already, and the visual language has kind of been set up already, and the themes and everything. So I think it's even harder for a television director to kind of stamp their stank on it, if you will.
How do you do that?
Yeah,
I've given a lot of thought to this, and I hope it's, I make some of the points I'll try to make here in my book. One metaphor I have for it, it's as if every show has its own language, and by that I'll include sensibility, tone, way of seeing things, way of camera works, all that. It has its own language, and my job is to learn that language so that I can speak it in my voice. It becomes not mimicry. It becomes, okay, these are some givens. These are some parameters. But now let me fully explore myself within those things. How, if these are the rules, how can I make use of them to fully express what I have to offer here? So it's a fascinating, it's funny. I mentioned that I studied to be an actor for 3 years. It's an interesting parallel in that, I have been fortunate to get to direct a wide variety, not just of shows, but of genres. I've directed The Sopranos, The Wire, Six Feet Under, Deadwood. More recently, you know, The Americans, Homeland, all kind of very serious shows. I've also directed, as I mentioned, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Buffy, 10 episodes, as you mentioned, of Entourage. I do comedy, and I'm attracted to a show if it's a new and fresh sensibility, because I regard it as an invitation to fully immerse myself in this new world, benefit from the sensibility of maybe an interesting showrunner, benefit from getting to work with new actors, new talent, so that I can emerge with a inside-out understanding of that world, and it can become part of my own process. But in acting, what's interesting is that, like an actor gets offered various roles, that actor has to find themselves within it, has to kind of conform to the needs of the story. What is the story we're telling? What is my particular role? How do I see the world? What are my imaginary circumstances? But you still feel it's the same actor. I mean, Meryl Streep can play a wide range of things, but you kind of know there's something essentially Meryl Streep that comes through in every role. And it's kind of similar, you know, it's kind of, or, you know, or you take, you know, let's say Hamlet, you know, say, oh my God, did you see Olivier's Hamlet or Ralph Fiennes' Hamlet or whatever? But they're all, it's like no one's changing Shakespeare's world, words, no one's doing it, but there's something unique because the presence of that particular person is fully animating, is fully informing that character. Well, there's some similarity when you approach a new project as a director. You're bringing yourself to it. So of the things you mentioned, yeah, every film has a visual language, say, for example, you know, and some of your older listeners might remember NYPD Blue, that kind of, was groundbreaking, and it had this handheld camera that no one had seen. So it was shaking. Well, you're not going to come into that show and said, okay, let's just fix the camera right here.
Wide shot, guys. Master shot theater.
You can't do that, but you can learn the language. It's another interesting feature is that what I'm always asking myself as a director in every creative choice I face how does that make me feel? How do I feel? What's the emotional subjective state this particular choice evokes in me? It can go, for example, in rehearsals, I'll watch a scene and unfold, and I'll have an understanding of what I feel the scene is about, what has to be communicated in terms of the story going forward, what we have to get out of this scene, what's happening between the characters. And as I'm watching the scene unfold, I try to stay open to what the actors are bringing to it before I make any suggestions. But as I watch them, you know, I might find myself, I'm interested at the beginning. Oh, I got bored for those, you know, three or four exchanges, and now my interest picked up again here. Well, I know that only by, you know, looking inward. It's like, I'm just not interested. Oh, now I'm interested. So where I'm not interested, I know, okay, that's where more digging is necessary. So what would make me interested in that? Or if this scene is being played in a way where the intentions are not interesting to me, I don't just say, well, it's a bad scene. I say to myself, what would make this interesting to me? And, or if I'm breaking down a scene with actors and, you know, they seem to be saying lines just because the script says it's their turn to speak. I want to find a reason why their character thinks to say that particular response, that particular line in response to what the scene partner is saying. I said, well, let's dig in. Let's see. What could the scene be about subtextually? What could really be at issue that would make your response not just appropriate, but would further your character's intention? So these are all things that come only from, I believe, looking within and assessing how you feel about what's being presented to you. And then you measure that against everything. Ultimately always has to be measured, in my view, against what is the story we're telling. We have to define that. What is at issue? Because a story is so much more than what happens. A story is the meaning you ascribe to what happens, the emphasis you give, what you want to acquaint the audience with in terms of what is at stake here. And that's really what the director can bring. And, you know, it's often been said that the art of directing is kind of invisible. Because if you've done your job really well, unless you want to kind of make a splash and kind of show off with a 360-degree camera move every other shot, and, you know, something like that, which can be fine to my mind, if it's in service to the story, if it's in service to creating the subjective state in the viewer you want to put them in to fully experience the story.
It's really interesting that you say that, because so many times, you know, when you're coming up as a film student and when you're a young filmmaker, we all see, you know, Kurosawa, and we all watch Scorsese and Spielberg and Coppola, and you see these shots that they create, like specifically that, you know, that one long 8-minute Steadicam shot from Goodfellas. Yeah, the Goodfellas shot.
Can I interrupt you to tell you one thing? I've just been directing Billions. I did the season finale of season 5. And now I'm in the process of just finishing up an episode for season 6. One of our camera operators is Laurie McConkey, who did that shot.
No!
For Scorsese, yeah. I was just asking him all about it, and it was so fascinating. And I'll tell you something that's interesting. So Scorsese, of course, is a master and a genius for me. But Larry's story to me about how that shot came about is instructive. It's not just, oh, Scorsese's a genius, he did that shot.
No, it doesn't work that way.
He said, okay, this is what has to happen. And Larry described me the process. Well, let's see, I'm following Ray in, but the path was actually not the logical path, because they go in and then they go around the kitchen and they come all the way out back to where they entered the kitchen and then go through a door. They could have bypassed the kitchen altogether, but it would have been a short shot. So how to make it look like they're making a continuous walk and not just coming back to, you know, so they devised all these things. And in the construction of the shot, you know, Larry was saying to, you know, Ray, it's like, hey, Ray, can you, I need a distraction here to happen so I can catch up with you when you're ahead of me. And then they say, okay, why don't we bring in this? And they started inventing all these things which are in the shot.
Sure.
That came about through a collaboration,
but that's
through a need for, the, you know, and that's, so that's the beauty of filmmaking. And, and it's the beauty of directing television or features when you're doing single camera directing. You know, it's such a beautifully collaborative process. And the one thing the director has to have, however, is the vision. And the and television, very, very much in a way that people may not really understand, you have to, you're the only one. Forget the fact that the, you know, it's the vision of the showrunner you serve, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As in feature films, so in directing series television, you as the director are the only one who is assessing moment to moment in the making, the hands-on making of this show. How do I feel about it? What is the audience's experience? Has the story point been delivered? Is the performance there? Do I have the right shots to edit this the way it should be edited? The director is the only one who says yay or nay to all of those things, who's saying, I don't think we have it, or I think we do have it. And, you know, shows will still get made and they will air and the story, a certain kind of story will get told, but how deeply the audience experiences it is can vary wildly between how different directors will handle it.
And it was funny because what I was trying to say, what the point I was trying to make with the Scorsese shot, which that's a fascinating story, by the way.
Yeah.
And that makes all the sense in the world, because it's not just a lot of filmmakers think that, like, you know, Marty wakes up in the morning and he has everything laid out and he just goes, you put this here, put this there, action, take one, done, let's move on. That doesn't, it's a collaborative art. Things happen on the day that you didn't know was going to happen, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But what the point I was trying to make was, as young filmmakers, you see that shot and then you try to shove that shot into your story because you want to be cool, as opposed to the season director who puts that shot in the back in the file cabinet. And when a story needs a shot like that, it is presented in service of the story, as opposed to where I'm just going to show off. And you can tell the difference.
I have a chapter. One of the chapters in my book is called The Language of Camera. Mm-hmm. And I describe early in my career, I was doing a show that involved, I'm not going to say the particular show or the name of the cameraman because I don't want to disparage anyone, but it was a show that involved three young friends, two young men and a young woman. And the two young men were best friends, and one of them had just broken up with the young woman, and the best friend was interested in kind of making a move on the woman, but he cleared it with him. Is that okay? And he goes, oh, yeah, we're over. And they wind up at a bar, and it's a scene is staged around a pool table. And the new would-be suitor is kind of showing the girl, the young woman, how to hold the cue, and it's very seductive. Right. You know?
Yeah, of course,
No, you just kind of, you know. Yeah. And the other has already said, claimed no interest in the matter, is watching and getting more and more pissed off.
Sure.
So the scene was about this growing jealousy in this guy. And the cameraman, who was very accomplished and was far more, this is early in my career, and he was far more a star on the show than I certainly was. And we had gotten along great and all that, but he came in and said, oh, this is great. You know what? Let's do kind of a swirling camera around. It'll be like Color of Money. Scorsese's Color of Money. Or the camera's just going around and around and around. It'll be awesome. And I'm thinking, well, that would be awesome. But I said, but you know, the problem is the story I'm telling right now requires a point of view. It requires, you know, this the one who's broken up with the girlfriend watching this, and the way I imagine it's going to be cut to tell that story is going to be intercutting, you know, increasingly tighter shots on what's going on. So it's not serving the story to do that. And the cameraman walked off the set. He said, okay, fine, you can do it without me then. And he went to the trucks and, you know, because he had fallen in love with this idea, and it was a very awkward situation and it was very uncomfortable. But when I got to the editing room, you know, I was very happy that I had stuck to my guns. Whereas in other situations, I've done shows where I make use of that swirling camera because it serves the story. Because right. like in another instance I cite in the book, you know, there was a story where I wanted to create a kind of dizzying experience for this protagonist who was kind of losing control of the situation. So the camera creates a subjective state. And yes, it's an impressive shot. And that's marvelous. I have nothing against impressive shots, but only so long as the impressions are in service of the story.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, and that's a great story, by the way, because if you start analyzing the swirling camera and Color of Money, I promise you that scene is not about jealousy. It's about something else. It could be I remember Color of Money, and it could be a montage, or it could just be Vince's, you know, energy that day, and he's just trying to show. It's a show off piece, and he's a show off character, and that's a show off camera move in that context.
Now I'll give you an example of a scene that I think is very cinematic that I did, that I am very proud of. I love the scene. It's very cinematic, but it's also what I love about it is it really advances the story. There was a season finale of a show called The Killing. Do you remember that show?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
Wonderful show. And in the third season, the finale, Maria Enos played this detective Skinner, and she's, you know, a depressed character kind of on the lookout, trying to avenge some inner wound she's had. She's a defender of adolescent kids, and there's a murderer afoot. And in this end of this last season, she's having an affair with her lead detective, her superior, who's her boss essentially. And in the last episode, she comes upon him when he's packing to leave his wife, and as they're leaving together, the wife comes home unexpectedly, and it's just excruciatingly awkward situation where Murray is like, you know, mortified. She has to watch, and she sees the detective give a hug to his teenage daughter. And as she's watching him, he sees on the daughter, on her finger, a ring, which is a very distinctive ring. And it's the missing piece of evidence, which not been able to find, which only could be in the possession of the killer. Of these teenage girls, this serial mm-hmm. killer. So she sees, oh my God, he's the killer. This man I'm having an affair with, who has been supervising this investigation, who I've been sleeping with, and I'm about to walk to his car and get in his car with him, is the killer. He doesn't know that she's seen this. Mm-hmm. So walk to the car, and there's almost no dialogue. And I describe in the book, and I won't go through everything, but you know, we did this, you know, we ramped the camera to slow motion as Mireille is walking down this walkway towards her car, the guy's ahead of her. I had her look directly into the lens. She's completely haunted. It put the audience in her own subjective state as she approaches him, and she's seeing the back of his head bobbing up and down in slow motion. She wants to leave this reality. It's so horrific. And what I used then was I had an ice cream truck kind of cross, and in slow motion, as she's looking at the back of the killer's head, her point of view drifts off with this ice cream truck with this eerie kind of, it's in slow motion so we could distort the sound, this children's mm-hmm. melody. So distorting all of the reality, objectifying that she wants to leave this situation. She doesn't want to hold her attention on the horror right in front of her. And then a boy on a bicycle comes back, and another symbol of innocence, kind of the camera pans back to the killer. He turns around, still not having any idea that she knows anything. He looks straight into the camera, breaking the fourth wall, putting the audience right in his crosshairs. Mm-hmm. So, like, and then we exchange just in a look between them. He understands in a moment that she knows who he is. And without a word of dialogue, I really, you know, hoped, and I believe they did, the audience really felt, you know, they've had a whole experience of a whole story point getting revealed and had shared the protagonist's inner experience of horror. And then we ramped back to live action, and she did what police do, and she arrested him. But that's a case of really being able to use the camera, you know, in a certain way, an impressive way, but only in service to deepening the story and the experience of the audience.
Now, when you walk onto a set on an established show, even if it's been a first season, but especially if it's been third, fourth, fifth, or sixth season or higher, These actors have been playing these roles for years. As a general statement, you know, when a director works with an actor, they're developing the character together, in features at least, they're developing the character together, they're figuring things out. There's still a lot of questions. When you walk on the set of Entourage, those guys knew who those guys were, you know, or you walk on The Sopranos, you know, you're not telling Tony Soprano how to do the scene, you know. So how do you direct actors who just know the character better than you?
That's a great question. I would say in those two instances, you know, I directed the early episodes of both Entourage and The Sopranos. Actually, I was fortunate David Chase had done the pilot, and we had known each other for Northern Exposure, which he also was doing. And he invited me to do the next episode after the pilot. They were down for 9 months before they went to series. So
he said.
So there was, and in Entourage too, I did early episodes too. So in those two instances, I was kind of on the ground floor a bit. But you're absolutely right. That is one of the fundamental challenges of two series directors. And again, I have a chapter where I address this directly. It's fascinating to me. It's like, and I'll say as well that, you know, not just with actors, but the challenge is not just with actors. The challenge is establishing command and being the leader of a set where you're the temporary guy, man or woman.
Right.
You're coming onto a situation that's ongoing. Not just the actors know all of this.
The crew.
Know they're better than you, but everybody else has been involved with the show much more longer than you have. So you're coming in to run the ship, to be the captain of the ship for a week and a half on set, you know, for 8 days of shooting generally. Maybe it's 10 if you're lucky. And so in addition to developing the qualities of leadership you really need to have, and that's not to say, you know, being commanding, but having command, you know, having a connection to the story, taking responsibility. Everybody has to sense that you are taking responsibility. But when it comes to actors, there's many more subtle issues. It's like, you know, it's their skin in the game, right? It's their mug up on the screen. Right. You know, a bad choice, you know, can really impair their whole future. You know, it's like if they come off silly. So I'm aware of the most fundamental couple of things I'm aware of is I need to develop trust very quickly. And how do you do that? I need them to see that I'm somebody they can trust. And how I do that, one of my approaches is before I ever get there, I've immersed myself in the show fully. And I've watched as many episodes as I can, or I've read as many scripts as I can. I've fully absorbed the script that I'm charged with directing. And I try to subtly let the actors know that I'm very, very aware of everything that's gone before. So, for example, when I start giving notes to actors, if I can, I'd like to frame it like, you know, this moment feels to me, you know how in the third season you had that episode where you were confronted so-and-so and you did such a beautiful job of kind of, you know, playing it close to the vest and manipulating the situation so-and-so. It feels to me this situation is somewhat like that. I think right away they okay, this person isn't just kind of coming in to kind of
wave his thing around.
This person, right? This person is interested in being a storyteller, which gets me to the other really significant thing is I have to make everybody understand what is true for me, which is that my only interest is in telling the story and not just telling the story, defining what the story is in an interesting way. So every show, every episode is unique. You know, it's easy to fall into a trap. Oh, yeah, it's just another episode of so-and-so. Well, it's unique. This is, you know, these are unique circumstances to this story we're telling today. At least unique in the sense of this scene has never been enacted between these two characters before. You know, this particular conflict has never been enacted. I mean, yeah, maybe in a broader sense, it's a repeat of certain things. But every situation is unique. And I approach it that way because I think, you know, being general is the enemy of being interesting. You know, it's like you have to make things specific. I learned that when I was an actor, and I know that as a director as well. And so I try to make it clear to whomever I'm speaking as an actor, I try to make it clear what I think is really going on below the surface, what the deeper intentions are, and what point in the story, what story point is being delivered here? What are we watching happen? What do we want to emerge from this scene with? How does it advance the story? And right away, I find actors are almost always engaged by that process. And they have to, you know, you have to have an interpretation that's interesting to them. It has to be something. But if they know you're serving story, then they know you're not serving yourself.
Right.
And you know, and they want to serve the story too. And you have to be able to embody for them the ways you are fully immersed in it and you know the story.
So I have to believe in the course of your career, there must have been a day or two on set where you dealt with a difficult actor and or difficult crew member. I think you mentioned earlier that one that kind of left. Specifically with actors, if there's a star of a show or someone who's been on the show forever and you're the first time on set, you really have – it's very difficult for you to have any you have no leverage. So how do you handle an actor who doesn't want to do what you want to do or doesn't see – how do you deal with that?
Another interesting challenge, and you know, as a part way of answering this, I want to add to the last list, which is it's fundamentally important as well, not just to – impress an actor that you know all about the story. I don't want to turn off that. But you also need to show them that you respect them and their choices and that you are interested in their take on the material and that you see what they are doing. So, for example, when I want to adjust an actor, and this applies to difficult actors as well, if they do something I don't like or I don't think serves the story, I don't, you know, there's an impulse we all might have. Like, oh, God, it's not, it shouldn't be that way. you know, you're sitting back at the monitor thinking, okay, how do I get that? But instead of just saying, no, not that, do this, you know, what I try to do when I give a note is I try to observe what I saw them do. They made a choice that I don't agree with, but I want them to know I saw the choice they made. So I'll come in and, for example, say, you know, I see that, you know, you decided to, you know, you played that moment by trying to overpower stuff. You know, I saw that. I think you did that well. I just think, however, I'd like to invite you to think about that moment a little differently. I don't think maybe that's, I'd like you to try a different intention rather than overpowering. Maybe I'd like to see you try this. Trying to work your way around the character as opposed to overpowering through him. I mean, I'll give them the adjustment, but it will be hopefully after I've conveyed to them, I see you made a choice and I saw what you did. Because, you know, we all feel better when we feel seen. And once we feel seen, we're much more willing to, okay, I'll try something else. It's not, you know, if you just come in and reject something, you know, it's like, so that's one thing. Difficult actors, you know, and I should say too, you know, there's so many cliches about actors. You're right, and I'm glad you couched it, you know, and of all the experiences you've had, there must have been some, yes.
Of course.
There have been, but far more there aren't.
And it's of course, yeah.
And you know, I just want to just put in a plug for actors, having been trained as one myself. It's so many ways the most challenging job any of us have.
Amen.
We're asking actors to carry the emotions that we'd rather not have, but we'd like to see someone else go through them, you know? What would it be like to imagine the worst horrific thing that could happen to you? What would that be like? Oh, I'm going to see this character.
And action.
Yeah, right. And it's not easy to act that authentically. You know, you can indicate it. You could say, oh, it would be terrible. But the great performances, characters are really exploring those feelings from the inside. So we're asking actors to be so vulnerable. And they're willing to do it for the most part. So there's something, you know, really admirable about that and challenging. So I'm very empathetic to actors. So I try to, and actors for the most part, you know, they're not just, you know, people think of them as egotistical or self-centered or narcissistic or difficult. And some of them can be. As I say, yeah,
but so like, so can some PAs.
Just like directors can
yeah,
be.
Yeah, exactly. Directors, PAs, right. You know, grip people, everybody.
So,
yeah, yeah.
All right, so that is a qualifier. Now, what to do with someone, and it's not just an actor. It can be, as I told you, I had a cameraman who was an egotistical guy, and I couldn't get around him. You know, they're all, you're going to run up. That's the other amazing, wonderful challenge, and it can be infuriating challenge of being a director. You come in, and you're kind of in command of, you know, 80 to 100 people, and and that you rely upon. And, you know, if someone is recalcitrant or difficult, or, you know, you're going to need their collaboration. So you have to find a way through. I'm sure other departments could say, boy, I have difficulty dealing with certain directors because they don't, you know, see things as I see it. They're stubborn. Yeah. But so with difficult actors, you know, everybody's unique. So every relationship is unique. You're having you have to do your best to connect to that person. Now, when they have walls, it can be very challenging. I find that generally, if I approach them with respect, that goes a long way. That's a good thing. If I feel heard, that goes a long way. I think most effective is when I appeal to them on the basis of story, not do this for me or do this because I think so. Or, you know, it's like, you know, when I say, you know, that's an interesting choice you've made, but I don't think it's the story we're telling at this moment. I think the moment here we're playing, this is the story. And I find a lot of difficult people are really just want it to be good and are kind of not trustful that they're going to be guided to appropriately. But if you can intrigue them, if you're, again, it goes to, if I'm interested enough in the story, can I get someone else interested in it? But then, you know, occasionally you run into the egotistical person who's not going to admit that you were right about something. No, that's a challenge. So there's just, you know, there's no how-to book here. I'll share one story I had. I had an actor once who was particularly paranoid, really, about he was a good actor, but he would always prepare, you know, how he was going to do something. And he would take almost any suggestion you could give him. It's like, no, I'm not going to do that. It's just, nope. It's like, you know, the actors are screwing me up. Directors are screwing me up, but I'm not going to take the note. And this particular guy, narcissism is kind of loosely thrown around, but he did tend to like to be the center of the scene. And I had a scene with him where a beloved character was coming into, a young woman was coming into this group, and she announced that she was dying of cancer. And the group, you know, was hearing this, and it was meant to be a huge revelation for the audience. She was a beloved character. And this particular actor he was very good at crying. And incredible moment of
look at me.
Oh my God. Look at me. And, you know, how to give him a note. I say, oh my God, he's making this thing about him. And, it was supposed to be, oh my God, you know, this young woman is dying. I mean, you know. So you have to be clever. So I came up to him and I said, you know, I think the audience is going to care more about you the more you can contain your grief and care about her.
Oh, what a great note. Oh.
We just heard that. He says, yeah, it's good. And it's like he just took it like it was his idea. I later heard him tell someone else on another episode. He says, no, people are going to, you know, it's like the more you care about something, they're going to really care about it. So it's like, you know, whatever works.
That was some Jedi mind trick stuff.
If the shoe fits, you know. But, you know,
And Dan, we were talking about this earlier off air, but, you know, after I've known a lot of television directors throughout my career and worked with many, and I've had a pleasure of working on some sets as a director, doing some shows. And, you know, seeing your filmography, I get it. And speaking to you and having conversations with you in the past, I understand why you work constantly and you're working at such a high level with such high level shows. It's not only are you, you know, talented, and I'm not going to embarrass you, but not only are you talented, but, and it's something that is a point that I want to make, is that I can sit in a room with you and not want to kill you. And that is one of the biggest things that filmmakers and directors and writers, especially writers in writers' rooms, never underestimate. The ability to be able to sit in a room with someone and not want to kill them. And that is, it is in many ways, look, we all have to be talented and you have to know your craft, but that one little equation is the difference between you getting the job or not. Because if you're in the room, you're talented for the most part.
And then, of course, there's different variations of that, and you have more experience in that. But do you see what I'm saying? So because
I do, and I'll say, Alex, I heard that about you, and hearing you say this now, I'm glad. I think the next time we talk, we don't have to put it on Zoom. I'll be in the same room with you.
Yes, absolutely.
If you're not going to kill me, I'll be glad.
No, but it's so important, and like I always like people always ask me, what's the best advice you can give me if I want to make it in the business? I'm like, don't be a dick.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. Yeah. I'll say also there's something humbling about directing series television because, as a director, you don't get the credit sometimes you feel and right. sometimes you actually do deserve. It often goes to, you might direct the pants out of a scene and the actors get the credit for it, even though you know what it started with and you know where you got it. Or you might make a scene really come alive and finding depths of within the material that the writers didn't even suspect and never mentioned to you in the tone meeting, but then they'll get credit. Oh, what a great written,
And the Emmy goes to.
Like, that's what I mean. It's kind of the invisible art. And there's in a lot of ways. But that's something I actually really like because we all have within us the tendency towards grandiosity and everything else. And then,
look at the business we're in.
The king of the hill. It's very easy for that to kind of emerge. there's a kind of built-in kind of tamping down of your ego that comes with doing this kind of job, which I actually appreciate. I know I'm going to look better if everybody else does their job well. And if everybody else does, if we make a great show, I'm going to get more credit. Yeah. So it's like, it's so much better just from a purely selfish point of view. And that's not my approach. I like people having good experiences. I don't like being a dick. I'm fully capable of being a dick. I have been on occasion on sets because stress can be great and the frustrations can be great and all that things. And, it's inevitable that things are going to be times when you don't act, according to your best self. Fortunately, I'm appreciative of you saying that. And I think for the most part, I do a pretty good job of being a reasonable human being. It's something to strive for. It's something, and you're going to do better if people feel respected, people feel seen. They're going to give you a better effort. And so that's just from a purely selfish point of view. I want people to feel good about themselves. I want actors to be able to take credit for, here's another thing about, for example, directing actors. An egotistical director sometimes will really glory in the fact that he or she is kind of, define the scene here, do it this way. Isn't that better? Yes. I know I gave that to you. And it's like, that's just, it's so counterproductive. I will always, for example, when I approach a scene, have a staging in mind because I've thought about it in my prep. I'm trying to find, first of all, I've defined for myself, what is the conflict here? What are the intentions of these characters? What is some physical action which will convey to the audience, even without dialogue, what is going on? So that it may, one goal of staging for me is, for example, to realize if you turn down the sound and just watch the scene, would you know what it's about through the behavior?
Of course.
You try to find things like that. So I'll always have a staging in mind, which is not to say I'm not open on the day if in rehearsal if something better comes out from the actors. I love that. If anything that makes it better, I love. But when it doesn't, or when you're in a time crunch and everybody's asking, okay, how do you want to stage this? Because we got to, start lighting. I'll have something to offer. But it's far preferable to me if the actors find that staging. Because if it's their own, if they feel they've connected to it, if it's coming through their bodies, through their consciousness, they're going to be connected to impulses that are going to enrich the scene in many more ways. So it's just better throughout if people feel ownership, if people feel they're valued, and they value their own creative resources. So again, just to repeat it, it's intelligent to be not to be a dick. Now there are times you don't want to make an absolute about, oh, I'm always going to be understanding and all that.
No,
because
no.
There are times when as the director you have to drive the boat or the car or whatever.
You gotta
get it made. And you've gotta kind of, if people aren't or slacking off, you've got to call them on that because, no one else is likely to do it. So it's a fine dance.
Yeah, it's like my grandpa used to always say, sometimes you got to show a little teeth. You know, every once in a while, you just got to let them know that the teeth are there. Like it's kind of like when you watch National Geographic, you see the lion, he's just hanging out. He's just hanging out. And then the kid just keeps pumping him. And all of a sudden, okay. Forgot you're the lion. Sorry.
Right. You got to remind people that there would be a consequence if you really,
if you keep pushing, the teeth will come out, which brings me to another question I think is really informative. Again, throughout your career, we all have it if you're directing, you go through this. There's a day where the entire world is coming crashing down around you. You're on the deck of the Titanic. You feel like the whole thing's coming down. What was that day for you, and how did you overcome that day? How did you get out of that hole that you fell into by whatever happenstance?
Well, yeah, I can take that on two levels. I'd say usually, almost always, you can anticipate what days those are going to be, because they're just like, for example, I just did, this, as I mentioned, the season finale, season 5 of Billions, which just aired like 2-3 weeks ago. And it's a good example, because we had a day that was, because of COVID, there has not been a lot of tourism in New York, or there wasn't, that's picking up, but I think we shot this around, I don't know, May this year. And there was a sequence where Damian Lewis's character is turning himself in to be arrested, and it was a helicopter flying in New York. And there's not that many tourist helicopters these days, we had access to this incredible landing pad right on the East River. Just beautiful, seeing all of New York City and all that. And it was a hugely written sequence with like 8 different cars with 8 individuals showing up, 4 more cars with police showing up, a helicopter landing, Damian Lewis, expected to get out of the helicopter, not getting out of the helicopter because he had done an end around. All these characters reacting to the fact that he had was not turning himself in, various flashback sequences to go into explain everything that happened, you know, several pages of work on an active helipad in New York City Harbor. And one of the prescriptions on this show, talking about visual language, is they love coverage on this show, and they love direct in the eyes coverage on everybody. So, you know, when you have, you know, 15 characters confronting everybody, it's like, you know, the famous challenges of shooting a dinner table scene. You look to the person there and you look to the person there. And then, you know, I'm sure your audience is, most of them are sophisticated enough to know that screen direction. But for those who aren't, you know, it's generally, the language is generally, if one character looks left to right, the one you're talking to is looking right to left. And when you have movement around, and when the film language of this particular show is that everybody has to be straight on, it's really challenging. And the producers thought, well, we probably need a day and a half, but that's... And I said, you know what, I think we only have a day. I think we can make it in a day, but it's going to be challenging. So I knew going in, this was going to be hellacious, and it was going to be a terrible cost if we didn't get it. It just takes tremendous preparation. You have to also learn to anticipate where this is where experience really helps, because you have to anticipate what, you know, how many shooting hours I'm going to have, how can we shoot efficiently. You know, in this case, and many difficult days, the way you shoot efficiently is to the description is chase the backlight, meaning you block shoot everything, so you're looking into the sun, and as the sun is going across the sky, you know, that's when you shoot the other direction, because backlight is always much more attractive and much more appealing, and it is faster to shoot because you don't have to create an artificial backlight because you have this, you know, beautiful sun. But it was just boom, 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 boom. So I had a rehearsal. We got all of these, you know, consummate actors there, you know, at 5:30 before dawn, so we could get out there and I could explain what the day was going to be, how we were going to shoot directionally, which means we were going to be shooting out of sequence a lot of the time, that I was going to ask everybody's participation and cooperation and understanding that it wasn't going to be necessarily the best for their performances. They'd have to kind of be able to jump in various moments and be on call to jump and get something else. And it was a grind, and we almost didn't get it, but we got it. Now, it comes about, and I could detail, you know, 100 kind of situations like that over my career, you know, in a book I write about, there's a chapter I write about the show Snowfall, the season opener on season three. We had a day like that. And I detail, I think your readers might, the audience might find it really an interesting experience. I found it fun to describe about particular challenges of the hellacious stunt and all this kind of stuff that had to happen in one day and the challenges and how we almost didn't get it, but we pulled it out by the skin of our teeth.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
There's a lot of agita. There's a lot of stress. But the main thing there needs to be to do it well is planning, is everybody being on their game, is leadership, is kind of there being one in command, not just the director. In these cases, it's the assistant director is very key. So that's one kind of really challenging day. Then there's the kind of day where you have unexpected things happen that just, you know, there might be, who knows, there might be an accident on set that, you know, is everybody has to attend to. And there might be a weather situation that can come up. It just requires, what's so exhilarating about it, as terrifying as it all can be, what's so exhilarating about it is you have to live by your wits. You have to kind of, another chapter I write about is entitled Interstates, because I think it's often unacknowledged what a wild array of emotions you go through as a director of an episode of television or feature films as well. And you have to develop an ability to deal, not just with stress, but deal with, you know, all manner of things. The image I have sometimes it's like diving below storm-driven seas, you know, and it's just chaotic on the surface. But when you get, you know, several feet below, it's just completely calm. And you can look up and you can see all the activity above you. You've got to somehow, you can't live there, but if you can just dive down there for a few moments, sometimes that's all you need to come up with a solution. How can we get through this? And you can find, and if you really stay. The other thing you really need to do is do your best not to panic. That can be disastrous. The way out, I can't. Because what happens then is you're not connected to the story. You're not. It's like, that's what I'm always doing in times like that. I try to always do it, period, stay connected to the story. But when you're really challenged on a tough day, you really have to think, what is essential to the story here? Do I really need, I don't have time for the six shots I designed. What do I need? What's the gist that I have to communicate? And often you, that kind of pressure produces a diamond. You know, it's like I've had that happen a lot when I've had to shoot something far more simply than I had intended. Mm-hmm. But it's so dense and rich and interesting that I think, wow, why didn't I think of that before? That's better. You know, not always. Sometimes it's disaster. And by disaster, I'm overstating it. I mean, it can be. Unfortunately, I can't think of it. Any instances?
No, sometimes it's like instead of the six shots, I got it all in one. But in your mind, the six shots, you absolutely you needed it to make this thing work.
And sometimes, a lot of times scenes will play a lot better in what we call a oneer. But you're hesitant to try it because you can't save it in the editing room if there's a problem. That's it. You're stuck with that. Yeah. So, sometimes in those situations, that's what's required.
I mean,
and there are shows, for example, that hate that. And they tell you, no, don't give us any wonders we want. We always like coverage and all that. But sometimes in those situations, that gives you leverage to go to the producers or up and they say, listen, we don't have time. I'm going to devise a shot that I think works well. And, at a certain point, all bets are off. You got to just tell the story.
Yeah, I was watching a show the other day. I forgot the name of the show I was watching. It's one of a Netflix show or something like that. And they did a oneer, and it just kept going and kept going and kept going. And my wife and I were watching it, and I'm like, oh, they're not cutting. Oh, this is nice. And it's like, and it just kept going and kept going. It's like, and you know, shooting oneers. I've shot many oneers in my career, and oh, they're wonderful when they work. Cause you're like, just knocked that 7 minutes off the, and right. I was able to do it. As opposed to having to cut 1,000 to edit 7 minutes, that could.
What I also love about wonders when they work, it's deadly when they don't.
Because you have no. I always give myself an escape valve. I always,
well, I do too. Yeah. Between you and me, Alex, I'm always looking for that too. Like, can I just grab off a pop of this person here in case I want to shorten the scene or whatever?
Yeah.
But the great thing about Warner's, I think, and you'll notice, I think, you know, it's interesting how many features play whole scenes in Warner's. It's like, it's much more a characteristic of feature filmmaking than it is television. But what I love about it is the experience it gives the audience, which is that they're not being spoon-fed everything. Like, God, look at this. There's more the experience, even though their attention is being manipulated by how you're moving the camera and how you compose. There's more the feeling that you're choosing what you're looking at. I'm having the experience with you in this. You're not being force-fed something by cut to extreme close.
Right.
And I think it makes a deeper experience often in the viewer. They feel like they're participating in the process a little bit.
And the show was Goliath. I just remembered.
Oh,
it was the last season of Goliath. It was
about shows that do that. I had a great deal of fun directing The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I don't know.
I've never seen it, but yeah.
Yeah. It's a fantastic show, and its visual style, I love doing it because it really encourages you to think in terms of Warner's. They do elaborate Warner's that feel like a magic carpet ride. It's like Amy and Dan Palladino. It's just they created it and they direct a lot of them and they devise this style, and it's unbelievable. And when I came in, I was just took it as a real fascinating challenge to see things that way. That's an example. It's like, okay, how can I absorb this language and how can I see? And it became so much fun. I did a show the third season about a kind of beatnik invasion of the Maisel's household and overrun by beatniks and everything. And you had, you know, Tony Shalhoub going crazy and Rachel. It's like how to create the subjective experience of Rachel Brosnahan, Mrs. Maisel, as she comes into this, this house full of invaders, like unwelcome spores. There, and it's just how you tell the story with what the camera sees before it pans off this and then 360 and then moving around.
Oh, it's great.
It's so much fun to design it. But again, that goes to the language, the particular visual language of the show.
But when you're doing a one-er, you're on the edge. You're on the tightrope. Because it's not just the actor's performance, it's the lighting, it's the camera, it's the focus puller.
And the heartbreak is when you get all those things right, but the performances weren't great.
If
you don't have that, you're dead.
You know? Or the cameraman bumps into a table and damn it, back to one, everybody. Oh no, but when it goes, it's when you do wonders, it is truly an exciting, there's a level of being on a tightrope, you know, it's not safe. It's really on the edge. So, but when you pull it off, it's pretty remarkable. Now I want to ask you a couple questions. I ask all my guests, for you specifically, I'm going to change my question. You normally ask what your favorite films of all time are, but what are three shows that anybody who's interested in directing television should watch?
Oh, that they're playing now.
Throughout the history of television, sir.
Wow.
If you want to do it throughout the history of your career, that's fine too.
I'd love to talk to you about movies too, but shows, you know, it's like there have been so many great ones that I'm, you know, and I'm embarrassed to say I'm not necessarily the best authority on it. I've watched a lot, but there are people.
Just your opinion. Yeah, just your
watched opinion. Far more. You know, the ones that, you know, The Sopranos and The Wire to me are about, you know, I don't know how you do any better than that. But some of the earlier, I mean, again, going back to that era, I also love the show 6 Feet Under. I think
my wife and I binged that a couple years ago and we were just in awe of it. It's like the tone, what they were doing, how they were doing it,
and
how
also
morbid
the
it was.
Of the
wonderful.
Experience.
Oh, the characters. It was such a wonderfully done show. I mean, I always throw out Breaking Bad because it's just
Breaking Bad, fantastic.
I mean, you it's know, one of those.
Like, there's so many. It's just a wealth of wonderful shows.
Well, then let's talk about movies. Three of your favorite films of all time.
Well, you know, when I was younger, when I was getting into it, one of my very favorite films was early. It was a film by François Truffaut called The 400 Blows.
Sure.
It was his first film. And it was an autobiographical film of Truffaut himself, how he grew up in a Parisian suburb. And it was, he was such a imaginative and yet misunderstood and unseen young child. who battled something. He was enacted by an actor called Jean-Pierre Léaud. And it was just the most personal and self-revealing and deep exploration of a life that was a very unhappy, a kid who had this incredible joyful connection to life, but was unmet by everything and was mischaracterized as a delinquent and a, you know, ne'er-do-well. And he winds up being put in a reform school on the French coast. And the last image is the one that just blows me away. He talked about never having seen the ocean. He runs away. He's been abandoned by everybody, his parents, his school, everything. And you understand him because the film does a brilliant job of getting inside his experience. He's a lyrical, you know, poetic soul and joyful and exuberant, but he's just kind of told he's nothing. And he runs away from this reform school, and he's just, and you know he's going to get in trouble for that and be punished more. But he's just running and running and running. He runs through the town, and he gets to the beach, and there's, you know, hundreds of yards of sand he's running in one long tracking shot. And you see all of his energy, and it's all, where's it going? He's running towards the ocean. What's he going to do? It's nowhere to go. And he gets to the shore, and he steps into the lapping waves, and he just turns around and he looks right at the camera, and there's a freeze frame of this young face against the ocean. And it's such a beautiful image of desire and sadness and despair. And the only thing that you know that redeems the whole thing is, you know, he's going to grow up to be François Truffaut and make beautiful movies. So that was a movie that continues to just move me so much. And at the time, it was very groundbreaking visually because it used the camera very energetically.
Sure.
Yeah. So I love that film. The other films that, I love all the whole canon of the Godfather movies, all that are fantastic. But, you know, the other kind of movies I find myself really drawn to, it's interesting, they seem to dramatize a particular conflict. And I would cite The Verdict by Sidney Lumet.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Scent of a Woman.
Martin Brest. Yeah.
Martin Brest. And another Lumet film a long time ago. It's funny what comes to me, you ask the question, but The Pawnbroker. And all three of those scenes, the movies, I realize this is a subject that really speaks to me. You have the central conflict being a character or characters who have been wounded by life and who have cut off, who have shut down their emotional life. And the story is they're fighting through their own despair, facing their own wounds, facing the depth of their disillusionment and hurt in order to reemerge, reconnect to life. And I find that just such a beautiful, that film can do in so many ways that can reach right into our souls and give us that experience. Because we're all challenged that way. You know, we all grow up and, our dreams don't get realized and we don't get seen or met or we get hurt and we cut down and close off. And in each of these films, you see the beauty of how it can awaken through relationship. I love that. It's again, like in The Verdict or Scent of a Woman, you got Pacino who's kind of embittered and this young Chris O'Donnell. And it's like the innocent one who sees the value and sees the beauty in the older one who's already given up on himself. And it's that, but who needs the older one to reconnect in order for him, the younger one, to get what the help he needs. And the Scent of a Woman is a brilliant script, I think, because after he saves Pacino from killing himself, Pacino then comes back to his school and saves the young man from being drummed out of school and gives him a future. And it's just
hoo-ha! Hoo-ha!
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, like it is. Sometimes you're saying people's dreams don't always come true. Sometimes you just want to make cake, but you made the best cookie. So it is that's what I think television and storytelling in general, films do so well. It mirrors our struggle as humans on this planet, and we empathize, and it is a great service that we do. I mean, we're not curing cancer, but man, are we hopefully moving the whole species forward a little bit when it's at its best.
That's right. And I'll say too, I'll add one other thing. Is my journey, and what I so appreciate is it's been a journey of self-discovery. It's like telling stories and serving story. What I've been forced into doing and I love doing is having to confront things within myself, learning who I am by what I'm drawn to in stories, and learning to explore things that I've in my life personally have been unable or unwilling to explore. In the make-believe of a story, I've been able to go to depths that I've been then later able to apply to myself. So it's been a wonderful opportunity.
And where can people pick up your new book, Directing Great Television, Inside TV's New Golden Age?
May I be so bold as to show a copy of it?
Obviously, you should.
Directing Great Television, Inside TV's New Golden Age. It's available on Amazon, and I hope people will read it. I think it will appeal not just to aspiring directors, but I think it will appeal to them for sure. I think it'll also appeal to just fans of television, because I really just relate a lot of I illustrate any point I'm trying to make by telling a story of my own experience. And I really try to put the reader in the director's chair. So this is what I faced. This is what the challenges were. This is how I approached it. This is what didn't work. And this is what did. So I hope people will like it.
Dan, I appreciate you being on the show, my friend. Thank you so much for being on the show and writing the book. And I hope it does help a lot of people out there. So I appreciate your time, my friend.
Thanks, Alex. I appreciate you. Thanks very much.
I want to thank Dan so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you again so much, Dan. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get his new book, Directing Great Television, Inside TV's New Golden Age, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/514. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show wherever you are listening. It really helps the show out a lot. Thanks again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's indiefilmhustle.com.